Yay. It's been 9 months since I did that. Doesn't seem like a long time, does it? No. Bit of background. No, hang on. That's the title for today's session. The actual working title at the moment for the PhD is "It Will Not Be So Among You," which you may recognise as a quote from the reading we had, "An Examination of Matthew's Portrayal of Jesus' Teaching on Authority and Hierarchies Viewed in the Context of First Century Greco-Roman Cultures." That's easier, isn't it? Yeah, okay. I just want to put up this. This is the only overhead I'm using. I'm just going to talk to what I'm doing. But I put up this overhead. It doesn't come from biblical studies. It comes from sociology. It's just a handy couple of definitions I found. A social structure is the distinctive stable arrangement of institutions whereby human beings in a society interact and live together. That's clear enough, isn't it? Yep. And social change is the alteration of mechanisms within the social structure, characterized by changes in cultural symbols, rules of behavior, social organizations, or value systems. Those last three things there. So social change is characterized by changes in rules of behavior, social organizations, and value systems. Every now and again, pop back to that, you'll see why as I go on. Bit of background. About 15, 20 years ago, I was reading my Bible, you'll be pleased to hear, and I was reading Matthew chapter 23, verse 10, and some words of Jesus leapt off the page and smacked me in the head, and I know I've talked about this before. Those words were, "You have one teacher, the Christ." And my immediate reaction was, good grief, supposing he meant it. Now, this was way before I actually went to Vos and started studying stuff, way before I took on the role of paid teacher here. And I started thinking about it, praying about it, studying some more. And then later on, when I did go to Vos, I was able to study it in a completely different way. I started to learn Greek. There are people there that, you know, who are New Testament experts, and I could talk to them about this verse. And after that, all of these years later, I am absolutely convinced that Jesus said it and meant it, that he is to be our only teacher. I'm not going to get into a long argument about inspiration of scripture now. I'm just saying this is where I'm at. This is what I believe. Bear with me. I also came to the conclusion that we, his followers, have lost sight of that central truth, that Jesus' teachings are actually what we're all about and what we should be promoting, and that this is why the church today has basically lost its capacity to interact with the communities in which it exists. That we just do not have in Western Christianity is not having an impact on the communities in which we live. I did my master's dissertation on this passage, and that involved, excuse me, very careful exegesis of the passage within context, in the context of the passage in Matthew, those words of Jesus. It was marked by a very highly respected New Testament scholar, Bill Loder, who I'm sure some of you would know. He thought it was pretty good. He thought it was so good that I should go on and do a PhD, which I'm doing. So when I was thinking about what to do for a PhD, I started wondering when and how the church started to move away, how early it happened the church started to move away from Jesus' teachings. That raised an immediate question: am I studying church history or am I doing biblical studies? And it was just a huge topic. It was really big. And discussing with the people of those who I now call the three wise men, that's Michael O'Neill, Michael Koch, and David Cohen. They said, well, you know, I said, I'd like to do hierarchies, but it's really fuzzy. And they said, do it. You know, they very strongly said, do it. And I thought, okay, sounds like prophecy to me, I'll do that. Bill Loder cautioned me against doing a PhD in New Testament studies. He said I should really go down the church history way of doing it. And the reason he said that is because for the last 1800 years, people have been studying the New Testament. and particularly Gospels. He said, just don't go anywhere near Gospels. He said, because you're just going to plough one more furrow over a field which has been ploughed and ploughed for 1,800 years. So I'm going to confine my research to the Gospel of Matthew. That's what I'm going to do. Background again, social structures in Greco-Roman societies were extremely hierarchical. Everybody knew their place. Everybody lived in a particular level. It was possible to move from one level to another. Even slaves could be freed, and there are certainly records of slaves who were freed who became wealthy, middle-class people. So, but basically, everybody knew their place, and it was very, very, very stratified. I will be talking about Greco-Roman societies in the plural. When the Romans took over, which they did quite quickly, took over the Eastern Mediterranean, lots of the Mediterranean areas, those societies weren't all the same. They were very, very different. They were little local societies. And basically the Romans said, okay, guys, there's two rules. One, you don't rebel. Two, you pay your taxes. If you stick with those two rules, then we won't worry about the rest. You can just, to a great degree, govern yourselves and carry on living the way you were before. So the societies were, though, very hierarchical. Jesus turns up and he says, you're not going to be like that. You're going to have societies where the structures are going to be very egalitarian. Literally, he said, you are all equals. Technically, he said, you are all brothers. It doesn't translate well as you are all brothers and sisters. That doesn't get the meaning across. So I'm saying you are all equals. He drew a line with himself on one side of it and everybody else on the other side of it. He said, I am your only teacher. You are all equals. He didn't draw a line with him, two lines with himself and then the disciples and then everybody else. He had one line. It was he was on one side of it and everyone else was on the other side of it. Greco-Roman cultures also placed a huge amount of importance on the seeking of honour. Honour and shame. In Greco-Roman societies, you sought honour, you avoided shame. Societies today have replaced that to a great degree with guilt and innocence. But to another degree, more recently, we've actually got rid of the whole thing. It used to be that if a politician was found to have been lying, then they were shamed and they often resigned. Not so many decades ago that would have happened. Today, if a politician is found to be lying, the politician says, doesn't matter, and everybody says, well, that's what politicians do. Society has changed dramatically. In Greco-Roman society, maintaining honour was incredibly important. It came from Greek culture. Aristotle regarded honour as being the most important virtue. Jesus comes along. And he tells his followers that they are not to seek honour. They are to do the absolute opposite of seeking honour. They are, in fact, to behave in... they're to humble themselves. And he gave himself as the example of humbling yourself. He says you're going to become like children or slaves. Children or slaves in Greco-Roman society had no status at all. They weren't at the bottom of the thing. They weren't there. They had no status. And Jesus says, this is how you are going to be. Can you see some of the problems that might arise when people started saying, okay, we're going to behave the way that Jesus tells us to behave, we're not going to behave the way that the society behaves? Can you imagine some of the problems? That's what I want to look into. So a few years after Jesus' time on earth, despite these teachings, you can start to see the church is starting to... what can we say? Go the way of the world rather than the way of Jesus' teachings. Now, part of what I'm doing is looking at the earliest examples of that, one which is obvious in terms of hierarchical structures is it's called the Council of Jerusalem. It's in chapter 15 of Acts if you want to read it. They've come together to decide whether or not Gentile believers have to follow the Jewish law. So this is a time when a lot of Christians saw themselves as being Jewish, part of the Jewish religion rather than something different. And there's a debate. There's some Peter's there, according to Luke. Peter's there, Paul's there, and in the chair is a guy called James, who isn't James the disciple, he's James the brother of Jesus. We don't know why he's in the chair. There's a big debate about what should happen. And then James says, I decide. And in the Greek, he does this in a very emphatic way. Literally, it would be translated, I decide. So James, the brother of Jesus, makes a decision. And according to Luke, everybody says, yep, okay, we'll do that then. So that's the first strong sign of a hierarchy developing within the church. There are others, but things get complicated when you start talking about them. I have to put in some... So that was the first sense. By the end of the first century, so this is 70 years after Jesus left the planet, you are starting to see the beginnings of the apostolic succession. The idea that Jesus appointed the apostles appointed other people, and those people must be obeyed under all circumstances because they've been appointed essentially by Jesus. So the church is getting these authoritarian structures saying, you will obey these particular people. So that's happening within 70 years of Jesus' leaving the planet. And also those structures are very much male-dominated. In the early days of the church, women had much more... Women had... Paul lists a certain number of roles. You know, he says first apostles, then teachers, then evangelists, that kind of thing. In the New Testament, you will find women in every single one of those roles, every single one. But by the time we get into the beginnings of the first, second century AD, so 70, 80 years after Jesus, you start finding they're just not there anymore. Women aren't being mentioned in any important role. I'm going to come back to that. Excuse me. There are certain things that I have to do as part of what I'm this confirmation of candidature process that I'm going through, and as part of this document that I'm writing, which I'm broadly speaking to at the moment, I have to come up with research hypotheses. And these hypotheses include that Matthew consistently and clearly portrays Jesus telling his followers to adopt egalitarian structures, social structures. Then I have to look at passages which basically say that passages which have traditionally been used to point the other way, to say, no, Jesus actually instituted hierarchies. One of those is where he says to Peter, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. I've got to address those as I go along and point out, discuss whether in fact they are instituting hierarchical structures. Another one is there's a parable of called the faithful and the unfaithful servants. You know, the parable is that this guy leaves his house, goes off, leaves a servant in charge, and the servant makes sure that the other servants get fed on time and that kind of thing. But there's an unfaithful servant who, in the same position, just gets drunk with his mates. And someone has said that is a clear indication. Some commentators say that's a clear indication that Jesus is saying you will have hierarchies because these people are set over others. So I have to address those things. I've done a fair bit of work on that, and I don't think I'll have any problems addressing those, but I've got to do it. Another hypothesis is that the troubles, this is getting important, this is getting interesting, I think. The troubles that Jesus' followers were to face in both public and domestic spheres, as forecast by Jesus in Matthew's Gospel, were at least partly the consequence of following Jesus' teaching on egalitarian structures. Do I need to say that again? Yeah, probably do. Jesus put these, I'll rephrase it, Jesus put these egalitarian structures, he said, this is how you have to believe. And these ways of behaving were so countercultural that the church suffered persecution. Persecution because people were behaving in this way, which was so countercultural. I'm going to come back to some of that in a minute or two. Do we have a clock? We do. We've got two clocks. The one at the bottom. Which one would you prefer? Oh, okay. The one at the bottom is correct. Okay. All right. All right. Okay. So there are certain questions which I'm going to be asking. Again, this is part of the process I have to go through. I have to ask questions which will test the hypothesis. And they're pretty straightforward. Are there passages in Matthew's Gospels that show Jesus instituting or promoting hierarchical social structures? If so, how can the tensions between these passages and those promoting egalitarian structures be resolved? If Matthew intended to portray Jesus as teaching that his followers should institute egalitarian social structures, I can't even say that, i.e. that none of his followers were to have authority over others, does Matthew portray Jesus giving directions to his followers as to how they were to organise themselves? How are they going to make decisions if there are going to be, you know, completely egalitarian structures? Does Matthew's Gospel provide any clues as to why Matthew portrayed Jesus teaching his followers to behave in ways that were so countercultural? And does Matthew's Gospel portray Jesus indicating what the consequences of having egalitarian social structures might be? I think it's quite possible that he does. Okay, good. We're doing well for time. Okay. I have to answer the question about the importance of the research. Apparently they don't want me to research something which actually isn't important, which staggers me. Being married to Bobby, I've seen seen some interesting PhDs. And within the whole sphere of theology and biblical studies, I've seen some PhDs which were cripplingly boring. And I would say that they're not important at all. But that's me. Different people find different things to be important. So the addressing the question of how important is this research, I'll read this bit. If Matthew was indeed portraying Jesus as teaching that all of his followers should regard each other as equals and have no hierarchical structures in their communities and not give or receive honour, then it's important to ask why at least some of those first century followers discarded those elements of his teaching. Why did that happen so quickly? The factors that caused his first century followers to move away from Jesus' teachings may have led, may have, you have to say may have all the time, didn't you? Yeah, okay. May have led to the establishment of a culture and traditions that resulted in hierarchical church structures that remain to this day. May have. If egalitarian structures were an important or essential feature of Jesus' requirements for his followers, then this is as important in the 21st century as it was in the Church of Matthew's day. Did you get that? Yeah, good. Right. Okay, next question, academic question. How this research will add to the current body of knowledge? How can I paraphrase some of this stuff? There could be a number of reasons why the church moved away from Jesus' teachings in those very early days. One simple explanation that I have investigated in some detail, because I thought, here's the answer, I thought, is simply that the disciples were ambitious. The reading that we had indicated that the disciples were ambitious, but there's plenty of others showing that the disciples were basically saying, well, you know, when are we going to get the goodies? So that might explain why the hierarchy is developed. One of the interesting things I found, though, and I'm still ready to be corrected on this, that not one of the 11 who were left when Jesus left the planet ever took on a position of authority in the church. Now, there are people who would disagree with me on that, but at the moment I'm sticking with it. I cannot come up with something with any of those disciples, including Peter, actually had clearly identified authoritarian positions in the church. James, the brother of Jesus, did. And Paul certainly talks about himself at times in the sense of having authority, but none of the disciples did. That's where my brilliant thesis foundered. I just couldn't find any evidence that that's what would happen. Another possibility is what I'm calling accommodation. As the church found itself under persecution, that the church started to accommodate to the prevailing cultures. Once you get into the 300s and Constantine's in charge, of course, then the church becomes very respectable. And but during that 200-year period, the church was under persecution, not organized, but there was a lot of persecution both from the Jewish authorities and the civic authorities. It could have been because Jesus followers were openly teaching that Jesus was the Messiah or that he was God, or they were referring to him as king, that would have been enough to ensure conflict with certainly with the Jewish, but also with the Roman authorities. But the conflict, hold on a second. The conflict could have been sparked, the persecution could have been sparked to some degree, as I'm saying, by the behaviours and lifestyle adopted by early Christians in obedience to Jesus' teachings. Now, this is an area which has attracted some attention from scholars in recent decades, but they've almost always investigated it what is called post-canonical. So they're not looking at what's going on in the New Testament documents themselves. If you read the New Testament documents, the persecution is because the Christians were regarded as teaching truths about Jesus which could not be accepted by the Jewish authorities or by the civic authorities. The idea that they were actually being persecuted because their lifestyle was so different has been looked at, but only sort of the 200s. There are certain Roman writers in the 200s who say things about the Christians which really aren't very nice, and partly it's about the way they behave. There are a number of passages, but what I'm looking at is Matthew. Can I find evidence for this happening right at the beginning, very early on? Does Jesus actually predict this happening? There are a number of passages in Matthew that portray Jesus stating clearly that following him is going to lead to persecution and conflict. Jesus warns his followers that they're going to come into conflict with religious and temporal authorities, but also, and here's where I start to get really interested, also that they're going to find problems in the domestic environment. Jesus says, I come to bring not peace but a sword. Your enemies are going to be members of your own household. Daughter-in-laws are going to be fighting with mother-in-laws. That's not novel. There's going to be trouble in the domestic environment. The thesis is going to examine whether there is evidence that these domestic problems were also were a consequence of following Jesus' teaching. This is something which I've only started wondering about quite recently. I've been researching this for a year, but these last bits... Okay, let's talk about women. We're going to do that next week, but let's start now. In Greco-Roman societies, generally speaking, in Roman societies certainly, there was a division between the public life and the domestic life. Men were in charge in public life. In the domestic scene, things are very, very different. And the churches met in the domestic scene until they started building their own buildings later on. I'm not going to go into the details as to why that... I don't know why that happened. It's not part of the thesis. So until they started building public churches, they met in the houses. That is, they met in the domestic sphere. That would make it very easy for women to have the kind of roles which we know that they did have through reading in the New Testament. In recent decades, feminist authors have examined this in some detail. There's a lady called Mary Y. MacDonald, who I think I may be in love with. I didn't bring her book with me, unfortunately, but trust me, it's an absolute cracker. Celsus, I think it was, the Roman historian, referred to Christian women and what goes on in the domestic, what's going on among, complaining about what's going on. This is in 200 and something AD, but he refers to them as hysterical women. Her book has got a subtitle, which is The Power of the Hysterical Woman. It's wonderful stuff. She studied the response of private members of Greco-Roman societies to the behaviours of members of the emerging Christian church. Now, try and think about this. Those of you who are intelligent women, you know who you are. Think about this. You're an intelligent woman. You're living in Greco-Roman society. I'll go back a little bit. Anybody here heard of the Augustan Reformation? Shook me rigid, this did. Augustus, you have, good, right. A little bit, yeah. The Augustus was emperor. He invented August. And he was very concerned about Roman the degeneration of Roman society, and basically he blamed it on the women who had too much freedom. So he instituted laws restricting women's freedom in the Roman Empire, including laws such as, for example, if you're a woman between the age of 20 and 50, you must be married. If you weren't married, you'd broken the law and would suffer. If you got divorced or if you were divorced or widowed, you had 2 years to get married again. But between those ages, you must be married. In other words, you must be under the authority of a bloke. The problem was women, not just women who were independent, but women who were financially independent was the major problem. Just to talk a little bit more about that, some people got around this rule by getting engaged and having long engagements. So Augustus said, no engagement by law can be more than 2 years old. 2 years long, sorry. He also restricted the age at which a woman could get engaged. Women were getting engaged too young, so he restricted the age at which a woman could be engaged to 7. Which means with a limit of 2 years on your engagement, that means you're getting married at 9. That's by the by. The important thing about all of the thing about the Augustan Reformation is that it happened between 18 and 14 BC. So when Jesus was born, and right through Jesus' lifetime, this is the kind of thing that was going on in the Roman Empire, the restriction of women. When I talked about different Greco-Roman societies, the position of women in those various societies, when the Romans took them over, were very different. In some cases, women were very much under subjection. Macedonia was a particular exception. The women in Macedonia, before the Romans turned up, actually had considerable freedom. So it wasn't even all across the whole thing. Excuse me. Any questions so far? Good. Sorry? Yeah. It's not just Macedonian women are. Yes, they still are like that, aren't they? They're also, I think, I've met some Macedonian women. There seem to be a number of them seem to be exceptionally beautiful. I think we're off the point now. I am. Yes, that's okay. Yeah. Hold on a second.
Just before we go any further, I think there's a risk in this that yes. It's egalitarianism versus hierarchy.
Yes.
And I think that would be a mistake. This is where I'd encourage you to look at the movement in Western management thinking, because I think it is power over hierarchy that you're looking at. So, like in nature, there is functional hierarchy for the sake of organising things. And so even in egalitarianism, you need to organise and have functional hierarchy, but it's not hierarchy that exerts power over. So I think you need to look at egalitarian hierarchy and non-egalitarian hierarchy.
Mm. Okay. Well, can we talk some more on that later? Yeah. I mean, not now.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I have another difficulty with the way you've gone so far, and that is that authorities can be informal or formal. And... I've written myself a note that I was just challenge you. I don't know what other examples you followed through, but I can think of one of an apostle, Thomas. There's a church in South India, in Kerala, the Martoma Church, had its own reformation, broke away from the Syrian Jacobite Church, which was more like a Catholic what's the Greek church?
Orthodox,
thank you, church. And they go back and they're quite clear that Thomas the Apostle founded that church. Now, I've no idea what records are probably very little written and so on. You may have great difficulty, but I think you'd have great difficulty in maintaining that Thomas didn't have enormous authority, but... Mm. It may be the kind of authority that plenty of Western missionaries have had in primary missionary situations,
yep.
where just by sheer circumstances, power of origination,
the Holy Spirit.
The Holy Spirit.
Yes.
Yeah. They've acquired an authority where their word is virtually law, even though that's the last thing they want.
Yep.
And I think that that's the sort of thing that may well have led to the structural hierarchies that you're being concerned about. And I'm not questioning that they developed, but I think that there's a natural authority of the founder.
Yep.
That needs looking at. And I think there may be more evidence there to be found.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you've explored. I don't know what the...
No, I'm restricting myself to Matthew.
Yes.
That's the problem with doing a PhD is you have to cut it down to something which is really, really...
I'm really challenging your statement that there were no other examples of apostles.
Yeah.
There may well be.
Yeah, I'm within the New Testament.
Not in the New Testament.
I haven't been able to find any.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks, John.
Oh, hi, Peter. I'm just fighting Trish off here. If you want to, just within the text, my suggestion would be to get someone who has a training in Euclidean philosophy to look at that connection between Jesus' statement about it not should not be thus among you, and your next step to assume that relates to hierarchy, because I think there is a dislocation there, but I don't have enough training to unpack it completely. So when Jesus says, this is how it is among the Gentiles, how they lord it over one another, and then your step, the next step to, therefore, this is about hierarchy...
No, okay, go on.
Yeah. I know you said a lot more than that, but I think that is one possible pathway, but not the only logical one.
Good.
But there are lots of people who are trained specifically in the linguistics of that that logic, so that someone who does that would be really helpful.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Peter. Yeah, you sparked me thinking about what authority means, and I think it's got variations. Like Jesus was recognized as having authority from what he said, not from his status. And Paul claimed authority from repeating what Jesus had told him. So I think it might be useful to look at the differentiation between authority and status.
Yep.
Because I think you're actually talking more about status when you're talking about hierarchy and authority within the hierarchy.
Yeah. I'm not going to get into discussion on these, but thank you very much for your points. Yeah, they will be taken into consideration, and they are very good. Did you say Euclidean? Yes. Yes, right, okay. Michael.
I think there should be a prize for somebody using the word Euclidean.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It may be the first time ever here.
I think so, yeah. Couple of things. The countercultural aspect of how women are regarded within Christian community is... it's interesting to note it's tacitly recognised by Paul in the number of women that he gives acknowledgement to. It's more specifically acknowledged a couple of centuries later. John Chrysostom is very tough on men who think that different rules should apply to women compared to men. Mm. And who think there's a different value to men and women. St. Augustine in City of God has quite a bit to say about, for instance, those Roman laws that were instituted to deprive women of power that have no basis apart from a power grab by men, and the blatant injustice of that. And there's a few other things he has to say about the innate worth of women in spite of how they are regarded by men in their society. So there is a thread throughout Christian tradition that is continuing to recognise those things in spite of the hierarchies. So that was one thing. The other thing that came to mind was to do with hierarchies and particularly the apostolic succession. Jesus appointed 12 to be the key people in his entourage.
Where does it say that?
Well,
that he appointed them to be the key people in his entourage.
Well, he named 12.
Yes.
He named 12. What is the significance of 12? They obviously thought there was a significance in 12 because they needed to replace Judas. Is there a prophetic significance in naming 12? And some would say that you can see that in, you know, the idea of the 12 tribes and the new Israel, those sorts of things. If there is a significance in 12, how did the 12 themselves see it? How did that shape hierarchies? How did other people who came after them see that? How does that feed into this idea of the 12 appointing leaders who appoint leaders who appoint leaders, mm-hmm. and that whole succession thing? So is there something that Jesus was saying in something that he did that was then interpreted in a different way down the track?
Yep. I'd love to respond to that now. I'd probably better not. I will just mention one of the things which set me off on the track of wondering whether it was disciples' ambition which led to a hierarchical system was Peter's use of the word episkopos in Acts chapter 1, where he's talking about replacing Judas. And he quotes a psalm which is turning up on bumper stickers all over the place at the moment, but never mind. Where he says, "Let another take his place as overseer." The verse in the psalm is, "May his days be few, let another take his place as overseer." The fact that it uses that word episkopos, which is often translated bishop, set me off on that track. Sorry, I'll just as a little aside, I'll tell you why the bumper sticker thing was interesting. I've seen bumper stickers both for Scott Morrison, I haven't actually seen them, both for Scott Morrison and Donald Trump, which say, "We must pray for our Prime Minister or our President." And then it quotes Psalm 109 verse 2, I think it is. And Psalm 109 verse 2 says, "Let his days be few, let another take his position as Yes, that's right, yes. That's unchristian, by the way. Please don't do it. I think I would just stop there when I was saying, can you imagine if you're an intelligent woman in Greco-Roman society, in mainstream Greco-Roman society, and you see the way women are behaving, or not behaving, but are treated, shall we say, that they are treated with respect, that they have positions where they are regarded as teachers, teachers of men, Priscilla certainly was, that kind of, can you imagine that you would just say, "Oh, that's interesting," and think it doesn't affect me? No, you wouldn't. You think, hey, you know. And within the Augustan, where women are being tried to be put down, then women who are actually having these positions, and a whole community who regard women as having been, should have these positions, is going to be regarded as a threat. Basically, could be regarded, may be regarded as a threat to the well-being. I'll probably come back to that in a minute. We are getting a bit late. Methodology. You can go to sleep now. I won't talk about methodology. Theoretical or conceptual frameworks. This might be mildly entertaining. I have to do something which we've had the word shit this morning, haven't we? Yes. There's what? Sorry? It's not on the tape. No. Oh, it is now. Okay, right. What kind of a church is this? There's another four-letter word which I won't say. It starts with a W and ends with a K. And talking about theoretical or conceptual frameworks, it just keeps coming into my head. I mean, what a load of rubbish, honestly. This is just speculation. People come up with these wonderful ideas about how you should interpret this, or here's another way of doing it. And of course, you can never find the truth, because if you're a theologian, you have to constantly be coming up with new theories all the time. It drives me crazy, and it's so stupid. I've developed a quote which you are free to disseminate through social media as much as you like. The quote is, "Theologians determined to determine the indeterminable interminably." Anyway, sorry, theoretical or conceptual frameworks. I have to talk about these. What I have said, because this thesis focuses on the countercultural nature of Jesus' teachings as portrayed by Matthew, it will use theoretical and conceptual frameworks that suit such a topic. These will include socio-rhetorical criticism of key passages, emphasizing the final form of the narrative and examining rhetorical devices used by Matthew in key passages such as parallelism, symmetrical syntax, and chiastic structures. Any questions? Good. A narrative critical approach which will not address questions about authorship, date, and hypothetical sources, instead concentrating on a detailed analysis of the passages found in the current form of Matthew. So I'm not going to be looking at authorship, I'm not going to be looking at date, I'm not interested in the various theories about what role Mark played in the creation of Matthew, how many people wrote Matthew. I'm not interested in that. I'm putting all that to one side by taking what is called a narrative critical approach. And, Ian.
Just a quick question. So previously...
Is it about socio-rhetorical?
No, it's about your focus here.
Yeah, go on.
You've said that earlier on that you're focusing on the fact that the hierarchy started forming early.
No, I'm not focusing on that. I'm focusing on whether there are indications in Matthew as to why that happened more.
So, but surely date or the authorship time of Matthew becomes important in the position of when hierarchies were formed in the church.
It would be important if we could establish beyond reasonable doubt what that date was, but we can't. People will argue about it forever. You know, some people put a date as early as 60, some people put a date as late as 90. And the arguments just go on and on and on. I just can't see any point in getting involved in that.
Sorry, just on that point then, does that mean that some of Paul's writings about, which included Priscilla and others, are likely to have been written before Matthew is constructed? So Matthew is written and constructed after these women have been involved in the building of the church. Something has happened and now they're excluded from the lists in Matthew, maybe.
Yeah. I may have to address that, mayn't I? Yes. I'm going to try not to. We got Karen?
Okay, I may have got some timelines crossed here, but you'll know whether this is relevant or not. You spoke about James, the brother of Jesus.
Yep.
There are a lot of teachings in the Bible about the slighted brother or the slighted sibling. Is there anything to do with the development of hierarchies in the church that might be related to that?
I don't know what you're talking about, I'm sorry. Okay, What's the slighted sibling?
Well, we have the prodigal son with the unhappy brother. You have...
All right,
You've got unhappy brothers of famous siblings all the way through the Bible.
This sounds like a new thesis to me.
Okay.
You could do it.
All right. So I don't know where the writing of Matthew fits, and you're just saying you can't time the writing of Matthew, but obviously James, the brother of Jesus, was existing within a lifetime after Jesus, and you're saying that there was some hierarchy in the early church coming from him, and I wonder if there's an element of the slighted, not famous sibling.
Hmm.
Okay.
It's not going to be part of my thesis. I think I can safely say that.
It's not going to be part of the discussion in the car on the way home either.
Okay.
Oh.
I don't know whether this is of relevance or not. I have to do an evaluation of my proposed methodology. Problems. There is obviously a problem in restricting the study to one gospel. I have to come up with arguments why I'm going to do that. It may not even be possible to do that. It's possible that I may have to broaden it out, not just to other gospels, but to some other New Testament writings, and also writings of very early but non-canonical documents. Everyone knows what I mean by non-canonical. It means they're not shaped like that. Very early ones, which actually do talk about how the church organises itself, a hierarchy. The Didache is one of the most important of those, and if you've heard of that, it's a very interesting and possibly very early document, which basically talks about how churches should organise themselves. It's a cracking good document too. Also, letters such as the first letter of Clement, where he very strongly reinforces the idea of bishop, the authority of bishops, and Ignatius also does the same thing. He says that basically you can't do anything unless the bishop says so. Can't get married, can't do anything, you know, bishop has to be involved in every major decision. It's not possible to determine for certain how Matthew intended his readers, if Matthew was one person, and if it was just all written at one hit, things which are definitely not certain, how he intended his readers to understand the writings. So a modern researcher can only consider what the gospel writer may have intended as objectively as they can, and taking into account the known ideological and cultural influences of the day. Greek culture was incredibly influential at that time, and certainly you can find the ideas of Greek rhetoric in Matthew, the Greek ways of expressing things, which means this is really important, that kind of stuff you find in Matthew. There are also acknowledged difficulties in establishing some of the passages in Matthew, time. In the Greek language, time is not terribly important. We tend to divide things up very much because we got much more accurate clocks and present, future, past, that kind of thing. The Greek language is much more flexible about time than that. If you can imagine a place where a day was a day, but an hour was, you know, when somebody rang a bell because they turned the hourglass over. You know, time is not so much important, and the language very much reflects that. But there are some problems. The best example I can come up with is when Jesus is sending the 12 out, he starts talking to them about the problems that they may encounter. He gives them instructions, you know, you go from house to house, you go from village to village, you stay in one house, various other instructions. And then he starts saying, by the way, you're going to be taken into synagogues and flogged, and you're going to be brought before governors. And this is all part of the same passage. But it's and then he starts talking about a message to the Gentiles, whereas at the beginning of this passage, he has very clearly said, go only to the lost sheep of Israel. So he seems to be talking about things which are going to happen well after they've gone out on this particular mission and come back, and some of which seem to be, to use the word eschatological, they're actually talking about events which are going to happen well beyond his own lifetime at any rate. So it's very difficult to deal with, and that's actually quite an important passage for what I'm doing. It's quite difficult to work out what the time structures are. That's one of the problems with my methodology. Conclusions. It's a good time to have conclusions, isn't it? What importance does this have for us today? Assuming that I can prove that Jesus' teaching actually was egalitarian, was that you will have egalitarian structures. When a new way of thinking and behaving comes along, there is always trouble. We're talking about social change here. When the rules of behaviour, social organisations change, there is trouble. Why? Because there are certain people within any status quo who are doing very nicely, thank you, and those people will not want things to change. In a hierarchical system, it's usually those at the top, not just those right at the top, but there are people throughout the area who are very happy with the way things are. They're very comfortable. They don't want things to change.
this may not be relevant, but that point that you just made is that people feel threatened by change that doesn't even affect them.
Yes.
And I believe that's a human thing. We see it in modern society. I'm sure it happened back then too.
Yeah, yeah. I will sum up very briefly. I would say that for the last 1700 years, the church has been associated with the powerful and the respectable. And I would say that that is changing. Not here, of course. Well, we may not be powerful, but I'm sure we're all respectable. The powerful and the comfortable. The church has been where respectable people go. This has happened since Constantine came to power in 300 and whatever it was. The emperor is smiling on the Christians. Hey, let's all become Christians. The emperor will therefore smile on us. And they've got this church and state thing where it was basically the same thing. And it's only now that this has changed. And I think we are privileged to be living in a time when this is changing, where being a Christian is no longer respectable, where Christians are increasingly saying, hang on, we're not actually supposed to be the moral police force for the rest of the society, which we're not. A lot of Christians still think we are, but we never were, I think, as far as Jesus' teaching is concerned. I think we're privileged to be living in a time when this is no longer the case. And the privilege is that we can actually promote the revolutionary teachings of Jesus. We are not part of the establishment. We are actually, as we were 1900 years ago, we are saying, here is something completely different. Here is a completely different way of behaving. We show it by the way we behave, by the way we look after each other, but we can also promote it by saying, yeah, this is what Jesus actually said. I think I will stop there. Thank you. Unless there's anything.